Chapter 9. Plumeek Soup. There was no reason to return to Calendar 2 once the away team concluded its investigations. The Maverick continued scans for a full day even though the evidence collected from the surface confirmed their worst fears. There were no survivors of Colony 1 left to find on the planet. All that remained of the 297 people who called Calendar 2 their home were the grains of DNA now mingled with the charred Earth. The only life forms to survive the Holocaust were the original inhabitants of the world who were fortunate enough to be in another hemisphere during the attack. Chris instructed Buck and Alex to conduct a decontamination sweep of the irradiated site in an attempt to dissipate the harmful Bertol rays. It took several hours to complete the procedure that required nothing less than a baryon sweep of the entire area. The whole process took its toll on the crew and Chris could understand why. There was a feeling of frustration and anger at arriving too late, as if their presence here might have given the intruders pause before causing the deaths of so many innocent lives. Everything they were doing now felt like the empty gestures of futility.
The sweep appears to be dissolving the Berthold ray concentration,
Buck informed Chris in the privacy of his ready room. Chris had confined himself to the place during the last few hours, tossing and turning the events in his head, hoping to reach some understanding but finding little success.
How long until the area is clean?
He inquired, taking a sip of strong black coffee that was now cold.
In about 43 days, the terrain should be able to support life again,
Buck answered, unable to ignore his captain seemed unusually sedate.
I've sent a message to Deep Space 5 informing them of what has happened here. I've been told that Colony 4 and Colony 9 have not sent in their monthly status reports. Both are now days overdue.
Buck understood the implications as well as Chris, even if he was not so quick to jump to conclusions.
You think it's going to be that bad?
Don't you?
Chris met his gaze sharply.
Those colonies are further out than this. Colony 9 is on the outermost rim of Federation territory. It sits on the border of uncharted space. We don't know what is beyond Colony 9 because we've never been out that far. I sometimes question whether it is wise to leave defenseless civilians on planets so far away from adequate protection.
Colonists are a very determined bunch, Chris. It's hard to break that pioneering spirit. I would think that they might have found a way to survive.
The door of the captain's ready room beeped and Chris activated the controls to allow whomever it was leave to enter. Alex Stiles stepped into the room with a data pad in her hand and paused when she realized he and Buck were having a private discussion.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
Chris smiled faintly.
That's okay, sit down, Commander.
She was after all the third highest ranking officer on the Maverick, and since this was an impromptu discussion on what they were facing, Chris saw no reason why she should not be involved. The woman raised a brow and sat down after a moment's deliberation. It was not often they talked, and during the opportunities when the moment presented itself, Alex always found the conversations to be interesting. To Alex, the captain appeared to be a paradox in extremes. There were moments when Chris Larrabee could be hot-headed and impossibly rash. Other times, he was so cool and calculating in his manner, he could give the Vulcans a run for their money. In any case, she was starting to believe that this was a man worthy of her loyalty, and it took some doing for Alex to feel that way about anyone.
Buck and I were talking about the pioneering spirit of colonists. Colony 1 was an agricultural settlement, if I remember correctly. They were farmers by nature. Colony 4 is a lithium cracking mine. I'm hoping we have better luck with survivors there.
Chris continued once she had sat down.
DS5 has lost contact with the rest of the outer colonies. We're thinking that Colony 1 was the last place they hit.
There could be survivors.
Alex was not so quick to discount the possibility of survivors.
If Colony 4 is a lithium cracking mine, there is a chance. The miners could be scattered over a large area of the planet's surface. Some may even be protected by the underground caves, if enough warning was given before the event.
I'm hoping that our guests don't compensate for that. At this moment, it doesn't look like there is much beyond their capability.
Alex could not argue with that. It was always assumed that beings of greater intelligence and scientific advancement would reason logically as most sentients do. However, time and time again, it appeared scientific intelligence had little to do with enlightenment or morality. The history of the galaxy was filled with too many species who found little difficulty justifying murder if they were motivated enough about the cause.
True, but I still think there's something odd about all this. I mean, if they're so damn powerful, why obliterate a colony like this? They could have taken the place without harming a single life form.
What they did is overkill.
Chris agreed, understanding what Buck was trying to say.
Yeah, Chris, I'm thinking this is more than just the destruction of a colony. This was a message to us.
Chris nodded because that was where his own conclusions about the entire situation at Colony 1 left him. It knotted his insides knowing those colonists consisting of men, women and children were used merely as some sick message by a hostile force to announce its presence to Starfleet and the Federation. However, there was something about that hypothesis that did not feel right even though his previous conclusion was only a natural progression.
Maybe, but I don't think this is about frightening us.
If that were the case, they would leave survivors so the fear can be translated. Every trace of Calendra 2 was obliterated. The area was radiated to avoid further habitation. Whatever the purpose of this attack was, it was not for conquest. If I were to make a guess, Captain, based on what evidence we do have, I'd say that this is an attempt at concealment.
Now that did make sense. Chris thought.
You're suggesting they came to Calendra 2 for some hidden purpose and maybe they found it and maybe they didn't. Whatever the reason, it was necessary for them to cover their tracks after they were done. Complete and utter obliteration of this colony would get out attention, but we would know nothing more than we do now.
Alex lapsed into a moment of silence and both Chris and Buck had learned enough about her to know that she had fallen into a train of thought that might produce an answer. The science officer did not speak for a second, but when she looked up, her expression indicated a purposeful response.
A scientific study.
Chris looked at her sharply.
Explain.
If I were a scientist and I wanted to conduct an experiment in secret, I would find a remote place to do my research. Once I had gathered my data, I would then erase any evidence of that experiment. Since I don't want someone else to learn about my findings by leaving specimens behind.
The thought was appalling, but it seemed to fit with what they already knew of the intruder. He was more than certain that whoever had downloaded the contents of DS5's main computer was also responsible for the carnage on Calendra 2.
So they're studying us.
Chris concluded without a hint of doubt in his voice. There was still much they had to learn about their mysterious new foe, but he was convinced Alex's hypothesis was correct.
I think she's right.
Buck said after a moment, giving Alex a nod of admiration.
It makes sense, Chris. They didn't attack DS5, they just pierced through the shields and got the entire database.
Yeah, Chris replied in agreement because his gut instinct told him Alex was right.
So I think we can all safely say that this is not the Borg.
Chris pointed that out as well so the notion could be finally done away.
I'm not prepared to discount the Borg as of yet, Captain. There are elements to this situation that have Borg characteristics. We know very little of the collective other than our confrontations with them. For most part, our knowledge regarding their culture, if it could be called that, is still very limited. This could be a pattern of behavior we just haven't seen before.
True. Chris could not deny this. Although my gut tells me that this is definitely not Borg because the Borg are highly logical and everything done on Calendra 2 is far from logical.
Both Alex and Buck looked at Chris in question, wanting to know what had led him to that statement.
The Borg have never wasted. Calendra 2 may be insignificant to them, but if the Borg attacked it, there would be no reason to destroy the technology or murder the people when it could all be assimilated. They have no reason to cover their tracks completely when they know they outmatch us, even with our lucky shots at them. There is no need for them to disguise themselves or eliminate 297 people when assimilation would have neutralized them. Whoever did this was not the Borg.
The certainty in which he made this statement persuaded both officers not to argue with Chris. Also, after taking into consideration the factors Chris had brought up, they realized nothing he said was untrue.
I am impressed, Chris. I hadn't even thought about that.
Chris smiled despite himself.
Why, thank you, Commander.
Alex, however, did not seem very happy.
So what we do have instead of the Borg is a race that thinks we are their lab rats and who possibly have the technological superiority of the Borg, who don't mind sacrificing any number of lives to conduct their study. Is that about right?
Buck frowned, deciding when she put it that way, the situation felt even worse.
Yeah, that's about the size of it.
Swell. I think I'd rather have the Borg.
In that context, Chris found that he agreed with her. After racking his mind over the possibilities, preparing every department for a possible encounter with a hostile, Chris gave the order for the Maverick to leave Calendra 2. There was no reason to remain and every reason to reach the other colonies as soon as possible. If the intruder was this far into Federation space, then he was certain they would have reached the outer colonies already. The Maverick left the orbit at Calendra and made its way to Colony 4 at maximum speed with an estimated arrival time of 14 hours, just enough for him to take a walk,
get a cup of coffee and have at least a few hours downtime before they arrived at their destination. He did not feel like dinner at Four Corners because his mind was still filled with bits of data regarding Bertolt Ray's and Transwarp's signatures. At the moment, he had little patience for crowds and knew he would not get the solitude he desired in the mess hall. Chris needed to let his mind rest or else he would be little good to anyone. A captain had to be alert at all times, and if Josiah were present, he was sure the counselor would reiterate his advice about the captain being sensible enough to know when he needed rest. Sometimes, having a counselor as a good friend could be damned annoying. Chris found himself walking through the ship, which in itself could take a good hour if he was not particular about where he was going. The Maverick was at least 40 decks and almost a kilometer across. For once, he decided to take the full tour because he needed the diversion. Chris walked down the tidy corridors, saluting officers, greeting the civilians who were also a part of his responsibility. He had to admit, he liked seeing children running up and down the corridors. It gave the ship life of its own and a deeper sense of community. He did not know how he ended up in engineering, but a few random twists and turns and he was walking through the deck before he knew it. It was late evening according to the Maverick's internal clock, and he was surprised to see Mary at an engineering console when he arrived. She looked up from her the screen as an ensign greeted him on sight. As always, she seemed perfectly composed, even though he knew she had put in a full day studying the documentation on all cultures in the area. Chris wondered what she was doing here in engineering.
"Captain, I didn't expect to see you here."
It was more of an accusation than a question. Obviously, she did not like surprises, Chris decided.
"I'm just wool gathering and taking a walk. What about you? Last time I looked, I was sure you were a protocol officer."
She chuckled slightly and responded,
"I'm brushing up on some of my engineering knowledge. I used to have a minor interest in it, and since I'm going to be on a starship permanently, I thought I'd brush up. After all, it would be good to know the difference between a power relay and an EPS conduit."
"True,"
he agreed, not denying that was a good idea. He decided to keep going, not wanting to intrude on her endeavors, especially when she was concentrating so avidly on fitting in with life on the Maverick. However, Chris paused when he noticed Mary eyeing him with deep scrutiny. Mary did stare at the captain for a moment, mainly because she was more aware of his physical state than he was. Her head tilted slightly as her blue-gray eyes moved over his face and looked deep into his red-rimmed eyes. Not only could she tell he was preoccupied, but he was well near exhausted.
"Captain, would it be rude if I asked when was the last time you slept?"
Suddenly, he felt like a child caught doing something he shouldn't, and like a child caught out, he found himself unable to lie when he answered her.
15 hours ago.
Her disapproval was obvious by stiffening of her posture and the sudden rise of her chin. Although her face expression was neutral, her eyes said it all.
"That is too long, Captain. May I also ask when was the last time you ate?"
Chris shrugged and found himself answering even though he did not wish to.
10 hours ago.
"I see."
Her brow raised slightly, unsurprised. He was a workaholic. Most captains tended to be that way, even at the risk to their health.
"I'm about to call it a night, and I haven't had a chance to thank you for allowing my son on the bridge against standing ship's orders. I've been told I'm quite good at programming a food replicator. If you like, I wouldn't mind the company."
"Are you asking me out to dinner, Lieutenant?"
he asked with a slight glimmer of suggestion in his eyes as he regarded her. Mary rolled her eyes and gave him a look.
"I want you to join me for a meal as a gesture of thanks to the consideration you showed my son. It is also one way to make sure that you eat. Isn't Yeoman Wells supposed to make sure of these things?"
"Technically, but I don't need a nursemaid."
He felt somewhat slighted by the notion Casey had to run after him like he was a kid.
"I can eat when I have to."
"I was not worried about you. I was concerned for the ship. Last thing we need is for the captain to be thinking about donuts before we go into a combat situation."
"Well, when you put it that way, how can I refuse?"
So far, all his instincts concerning Mary Travis had said the same thing: stay away. Chris knew he was attracted to her. There was really no way to deny it. She was, in his opinion, the loveliest female he had ever seen, if not a little glacial. However, he understood it had to do with her Vulcan background. There were aspects of her that were warm and tender. Chris had seen it. He knew she could be flexible when required, and her sense of humor, though subtle, did actually exist. Although she was accustomed to being around Vulcans, there was something about Mary he found utterly compelling and impossible to ignore. Whether or not it was a conscious decision or simply one of practicality,
She had no difficulty coping with her gender. She was a woman and a mother. Unlike other career women in Starfleet who tried unsuccessfully to mask their femininity in order to seem professional, Chris found it ironic that a somewhat cool-natured female could make her presence felt so strongly by simply being herself. He arrived at her quarters about 15 minutes after their meeting in engineering to find her more than prepared for him. As he was shown in, he had expected to see William running through the room as boys were supposed to. However, the room remained silent and Chris saw no trace of the boy. "Where is Billy?" he asked as they made their way to the dining table. Mary had already set out the meal and Chris could not help taking a deep breath of the exotic aroma. Until he smelled hot plumeek soup, he had not realized he was so hungry. Mary looked over her shoulder and gave him a look.
"Billy?"
"Sorry," Chris immediately apologized with a faint smile. "I got used to calling him that during our tour."
"Billy?"
she mused with a raised brow before a little smile crossed her lips. She had to admit she liked how that sounded. Billy did seem much more informal than William for a six-year-old boy.
"William is staying with Lieutenant Kala's son, Bodhi."
Once again, the aroma assaulted him and Chris scolded himself for not eating sooner.
"They've been playmates since our arrival here. He's staying at the lieutenant's quarters tonight."
"You mean they're having a sleepover?"
"Something like that."
She nodded, remembering the term from her own childhood, and was somewhat surprised that she had not thought of it herself. Perhaps she had been on Vulcan for too long. As they sat down to the meal, Chris wondered how she fared without a husband. Did she still miss him terribly? During the first few months after Sarah and Adam had died, the absence almost killed him with loneliness. Even now, he still felt an ache inside his soul each time he walked into his quarters because a part of him expected them to be there. Mary had lived on Vulcan for most of her married life and had adopted many of their attitudes. Did she grieve the same way?
"Is it hard to be born a hybrid on Vulcan?"
Chris asked once they were into the main course. Mary did not look surprised by the question. She put her fork down and considered her answer.
"No species is entirely loyal to the rules they set down for themselves. Vulcans are no different. They live up to an ideal, but sometimes that ideal is too much even for them to fully accept. Vulcans believe IDIC is the cornerstone of enlightenment and logic. Without it, everyone, not just Vulcans, are no better than their warlike ancestors of generations past. While they believe in it, they also believe their way of life is no easy thing for other species to understand. Non-emotion has accomplished much for them, but it is an alien existence some find impossible to comprehend. So, they tend to marry within their species, not because of purity but because they understand such a life is too much to ask of anyone who is not born of Vulcan."
"People can learn,"
he pointed out, well aware that IDIC, short for Infinite Diversity and Infinite Combination, was easier to say than live by.
"You did."
"Not easily. Sion was not like other Vulcans and he was very patient. Generations of genetics have made Vulcans what they are. Their ancestors who gave up the warring ways decided to hone their minds for logic. It has been that way for so much time that finally it has been imprinted in an evolutionary level. When one of them marries a human, they wonder if a child of that union will have the tools necessary to live up to their way of life. There are those in every society who will be more vocal about such concerns. They do not mean to be ignorant, but they are incapable of understanding that nature is far from logical. They look at William strangely, and while they never exactly show he is different to them, I can sense it. Sion always told me that there was no basis for that conclusion, but a mother knows."
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable."
He was only curious to know about Vulcan opinions about interspecies marriage because of how shy and withdrawn William seemed to be.
"I have not asked you how Billy has been."
Although she did not smile, he saw her disposition brighten considerably.
"He is beginning to make acquaintances on the ship. He spoke of nothing but the visit to the bridge for days and told me that he was going to become a starship captain in the future."
"Would you mind?"
"I'm his mother. Anything dangerous concerns me."
"That it is. It's a dangerous life and it can even be lonely. You spend a lot of your time hoping that you don't screw up somehow and get people killed and hope you can rise to the occasion when necessary. It can be difficult to balance out your responsibility to yourself and your crew."
"I would like him to find his own way. His father wanted him to be a Starfleet officer when he became a man. My in-laws believe he should be sent to study on Vulcan and to become a member of the Science Academy someday."
"What do you want?"
he asked, meeting her eyes. For a moment, the question took her by surprise and the glacial expression melted.
Her eyes became fluid in that moment and her face softened with emotion.
I want him with me.
The moment lasted a second and she blinked it away, somewhat embarrassed that she had made such an emotional display in front of the captain. No matter how much their relationship was moving to something that bordered on warm familiarity and possibly something deeper than that.
I'm probably being selfish,
she said abruptly, her cheeks flushed red with embarrassment. Why? You're his mother. Why wouldn't you want him with you?
I should choose the best path for him.
And until he's old enough to decide what he wants, you need to choose the path that is best for him as a child, not for what he is going to be in the future. He's a great kid, Mary, but let him be that for a while. Let him enjoy it before he grows into what is deemed appropriate for Vulcan.
And until he's old enough to decide what he wants, you need to choose the path that is best for him as a child, not for what he is going to be in the future. He's a great kid, Mary, but let him be that for a while. Let him enjoy it before he grows into what is deemed appropriate for Vulcan.
For a moment, she remained silent. While the captain would undoubtedly call this one of those awkward moments, she would have strongly disagreed if he voiced the opinion. Instead, her mind was whirling with possibilities. It made her wonder if he had some telepathic ability that could read her because he seemed to know what she was thinking in her innermost self. After being bonded with a Vulcan in marriage, Mary knew Sion had helped her strengthen her own telepathic bonds enough to be able to sense people with clarity. Vulcans seldom divorced because of their matrimonial mind meld. Being so in tune with each other often made it difficult to find discord. Yet somehow, as easily as Chris Larrabee could read her, Mary was finding that she had a very strong sense of him as well. Perhaps the link inside her mind was re-establishing itself because of her growing affection for this man. As Mary met her captain's gaze, she began to see him as more than just a face attached to a Starfleet uniform. Suddenly, he had become more than that to her, and Mary was unsure it was different she would have advocated had she known its coming. Mary did not wish to know Captain Chris Larrabee as a man. Because the man was beginning to mean something to her. Chapter 10. Survivors. To be honest, Chris Larrabee knew what they were going to find on Colony 4 long before they arrived within the star system. When Deep Space 5 had not received the colony's monthly status reports, they had informed Chris immediately. With this knowledge in mind, Chris feared the worst. Actually, he more than feared it. He knew its destruction was an inevitability. He was starting to develop a sixth sense about this incident and understood something terrible was at work in this uncharted corner of the galaxy. Colony 4 was located on the sixth planet of the star system known as Omega Prime. Omega Prime's native star was a massive body slowly moving into the tertiary phase of its development. In 1,000 years or more, it would evolve into a ferocious red giant and effectively wipe out what scant life existed in the planets of its sphere. Omega 6 was the only world inside the system whose temperatures were capable of supporting humanoid life. Its surface was a hellish place of hot, burning winds and dry desert sand. It produced very little rainfall and was only capable of sustaining a sparse population of cacti and lichens. They picked up the remote distress signal on their journey to Colony 4 and were rewarded with static silence when they attempted to hail the settlement on approach. The tension on the ship skyrocketed with its silence and everyone began to suspect they would find the same destruction on Colony 4 as they had done on Colony 1. Chris sent a priority communication to Starfleet Command explaining the situation to date. In response, Starfleet ordered him to monitor the situation closely and be careful. Chris intended to do both. However, he had harbored a secret hope some miracle might have spared Colony 4. Unfortunately, it appeared they were going to be subjected to a repeat performance of the destruction on Calandra 2. The bridge was strangely quiet as they moved into the orbit of Omega 6. All senior bridge officers were present and Chris let his gaze move across their faces and saw their concentration. Buck had informed him that Ezra had spent much of his off-duty hours running Borg attack simulations for the ship. Even now, Chris could see the man's eyes fixed on the security station before him, with his usual poker face replaced by an expression of utmost concentration that was taut with tension. JD was maintaining his calm even though Chris recognized the look of the novice under pressure. His eyes darted back and forth over his console, trying to access all the information before him. Chris knew Ezra and Julia had been running battle simulations in tandem with gauging the ship's response to such scenarios. The chief engineer ensured their cloaking device was operational and not untested before a real battle. In the meantime, Nathan informed him that a medical team would be ready to transport the moment they arrived in orbit around Omega-6. Chris knew for a fact it had affected the chief medical officer when there were no survivors to be found on Calandra. Chris hoped they might have better luck. Mary was sitting on his left flank. Her shapely legs were folded while her slender fingers drummed softly against the fabric of her chair. Although she showed no outward signs of concern, her eyes were moving across the bridge with as much scrutiny as his. No doubt, she was starting to feel the same pressure as the rest of the bridge. "Viewer on," Chris ordered once the hum of the impulse engines came to a dead stop. Although he could not see the stars outside, he knew Omega-6 lay below them. The viewer came to life before he finished the sentence. Omega-6 appeared before him, a glowing orb of black cloud suspended against a vibrant canopy of stars. In the distance, the massive sun Omega Prime looked on, unconcerned. The sheer size of the amber star made it appear as if Omega-6 had an enormous moon in orbit around it. The planet itself was a golden sphere of hot, baked sand and turbulent desert storms. Even from space, Chris wondered how any creature could call it home. As it revolved slowly below them, Chris could see a familiar dark spot appearing across the face of the planet. It was the same scarring they witnessed on Calendar 2. No one spoke for a moment because there were no words to describe the intensity of their feelings. A fog of futility and hopelessness moved through the bridge like a wraith in the dark. Once again, they were too late. Their mysterious enemy had reached the colony first and exacted another terrible attack. Chris tried not to look disappointed because his crew needed him to keep faith for all of them, but nothing could wipe the grim expression from his features in light of the discovery.
"Alex, begin scanning," he ordered softly.
As unlikely as it might be, Chris refused to give up any vestiges of hope until all avenues of inquiry had been exhausted.
"Scanning, sir."
The science officer had begun scanning the planet ever since they had dropped out of impulse speed. So far her findings had given her very little reason to be hopeful of any positive outcome.
"Captain, I am detecting similar Berthold ray emissions from the settlement as we found on Calendra 2. It is undoubtedly the same weapon used to destroy Colony 1.
Chris let out a held breath, but he was unsurprised by the news.
"Confirmed, Captain,"
Ezra added a second later.
"I am picking up traces of transwarp signatures throughout the area. They match the signatures we found at Calendra 2. I do not doubt these are the same intruders. Captain, they were definitely here."
"I think you're right, Ezra. Continue."
The security officer nodded shortly and spoke further.
"I am able to determine that the rate of signature degradation is more pronounced here than those found at Calendra. I estimate that this took place some time ago."
Chris turned to Buck.
"I guess we were right. They were here first."
Buck did not answer for a few seconds. His gaze was fixed on the image in the viewer.
"Then we have to proceed on the assumption that Colony 9 has also been destroyed,"
the first officer replied neutrally, even though he felt a wave of helplessness twisting his innards with the futility of their effort. Colony 9 was even further out of reach than these unfortunate settlements. Judging from the current trajectory the invaders seemed to be traveling, it was an inevitability that Colony 9 was attacked first.
"Recommend that we go to Yellow Alert.
Ezra, take the ship to Yellow Alert."
Ezra nodded in response and immediately fed the appropriate instructions into his console screen. Across the Maverick, alert panels began flashing yellow. Civilians were ushered back to their quarters for the interim until the risk was over. Other crew members across the ship were making their way to their post in order to be on standby should the ship encounter any unexpected hostiles.
"Captain, this could be the beginning of an invasion. They have already attacked three of our colonies. We must notify Starfleet Command."
"No, this is not an invasion."
The certainty of his statement froze the bridge, and he knew his crew wanted elaboration on how he could make such a judgment with absolute confidence.
"If this were an invasion,"
Buck took the liberty of explaining,
"an invasion force would find better targets than three small colonies. Despite the loss, none of these hold any strategic importance to the Federation. An enemy with enough technological superiority to have transwarp ships and a weapon capable of mutating atomic structure can find better targets in this sector."
"I've already informed Starfleet Command of the situation,"
Chris replied for the benefit of anyone else wondering.
"However, I'm not convinced we have the facts to assume that this is an invasion. There is something else going on here."
Alex, whom none of them had been paying attention to while they making their speculations, suddenly spoke up.
"Captain, I am detecting humanoid life signs on the surface of the planet."
Chris articulated his amazement first.
"Where?"
"About 400 kilometers north from the location of the settlement. I read about 20 people.
How could they have survived?
They're probably miners. Omega-6's most famous natural resource is dilithium. If they were mining underground at the time of the attack, they may have escaped being killed along with the rest of the colony.
Why did the attackers not scan for them? Any race advanced enough to do what was done to Kalendra 2 would not be so careless.
Under normal circumstances, yes.
Alex replied, suddenly understanding how this could happen.
However, dilithium is known to interfere with certain types of scanning beams. If this was a fact previously unknown to the attackers, they may not have adjusted their beams to compensate for the disruption.
In any case, Chris interrupted, we can discuss this later. It looks like we've got a rescue operation on our hands, people.
Chris tapped his comm badge.
Dr. Jackson, have you been monitoring the situation?
Yes, sir.
Nathan's voice responded enthusiastically.
My team is on standby to transport down.
Acknowledged. Stand by for further instructions. He turned to Buck. Buck, you'll lead the away team.
Captain, we do not have all the facts. I am as happy as anyone that there are survivors on the planet, but until we have a clearer understanding of the situation, I would recommend that the away team be accompanied by a full security team.
He's right.
Buck voiced his agreement. Very well. Chris nodded. Prepare your team, Ezra, and proceed to Transporter 2.
When the away team materialized on Omega-6, they found themselves flanked on either side by a massive wall of rock that seemed endless in its ascent. The passageway into which they transported was no more than a few meters wide, although it was hard to tell because the height of the walls allowed for any visible light. Buck took a few moments to adjust his vision to the lack of visibility. This world reminded him of Vulcan and the brightness of its native star, Aridini. The ferocity of the Vulcan sun bore down on all the planets, so it was never really dark even though it was night. Judging by the lay of the land, Buck estimated that from a high altitude, this canyon would be nothing more than an enormous slab of rock lying flat. He noticed the walls of the canyon were smooth and the ground beneath his feet was dried silt. Before Omega Prime had descended into its natural decay, this was the path of a river. However, soaring temperatures had dried up the waterway, leaving nothing in its wake except for a baked riverbed. He looked up and saw the thin light of the sky shining through the cleft in the mountain. Sunlight was struggling to reach them and made it only halfway. The advantage, he supposed, is that they were spared the blistering heat of Omega Prime on their skin. Though cool, the temperature was tolerable.
This way,
Ezra stated after taking the proper readings from his tricorder.
I detect life signs 200 meters ahead.
His gaze moved northward, following the meandering path of the passageway through the rock.
Very well, Lieutenant. Lead the way.
How in the rings did they get in here?
Nathan mused as the group started moving forward with Ezra and his security team leading the way.
You'd be lucky to get a ship down here.
A small shuttle could do it, if the pilot is skilled enough, but I'm pretty sure there is an alternate entry point into the canyon with access for some sort of terrestrial vehicle.
I suppose, but it would be an arduous trip that I wouldn't envy. It's a wonder that they managed to stay alive.
They are indeed fortunate that the effects of dilithium could render sensor scans ineffective, or else the intruder would have found them as easily as we have done so now.
Buck felt the heat against his skin and wondered what it must be like to be trapped in a hellish place like this with no idea whether or not help was coming.
Yeah, I'll bet they're feeling real lucky.
It did not take them long to find the remnants of Colony 4. There were survivors as expected, but the state of the group was appalling. With nothing more than the tools they had been working with and the meager rations of their campsite, the miners of Colony 4 had survived for nearly 25 days. As Buck and Chris guessed, these men and women had been working in a dilithium mine some distance from here from the catastrophe that took place. The mine was located almost under a kilometer of rock, and this was the only thing that saved them from being killed like the rest of their friends and family. When the Starfleet officers arrived on the scene, the medical team immediately deployed themselves like soldiers in a carefully planned campaign. The campsite was a collection of portable shelters and apparently one replicator normally used to produce mining tools. Since the disaster, however, it became the main source of water. Realizing that the replicator power had to sustain them indefinitely, the production of water was carefully rationed. Food came from dehydrated packs that were used sparingly. Most had given up the notion of a rescue, and others were succumbing to the raving effects of exposure and malnutrition.
What have we got, Nathan?
Buck asked after allowing the medical team sufficient time to do their work. Ezra and his security team had lent a hand as nurses, aiding the medics as they evaluated the health of the survivors.
Well, all of them are suffering from exposure and malnutrition, which is to be expected, of course. They survived because they were careful from the beginning. I've got 3 cases of mild Bertholdt ray poisoning. Apparently, they attempted to return to the colony site to see the extent of the damage. They were wise enough to turn back before they were severely contaminated. It was a good thing that we arrived when we did, Commander. They would not have survived another week like this.
Understood. Get them ready for transport to the ship.
Right.
Nathan nodded and went off to instruct his team on just that order. At that moment, Ezra approached him with one of the survivors, a rather exhausted-looking man who in his prime could be described as burly. Now, he appeared as if his skin was the only thing that was holding his bones together. The man looked terribly emaciated as his eyes stared back at Buck through hollow sockets.
Commander, this is Supervisor Lars Croft. Apparently, there was some odd goings on before the destruction of Colony 4.
Odd?
Buck's natural curiosity wished to know what exactly the man had seen, but at the moment, Lars needed medical treatment more than he required to give testimony. There would be ample time for discussion about the attack once they returned to the ship.
I know you want to tell your story, Supervisor, but it's not necessary for you to do that immediately. You need medical attention, and in any case, I think the captain would like to be present when you do give us your story.
Thank you. You are most kind. We had given up hope of being found. There is always a risk to build a colony so far from Federation space, but until now, we never imagined.
His voice faltered then, and Ezra squeezed his shoulder for support.
We understand. Please let us get you some medical attention first on board the Maverick.
Lars seemed grateful for the security officer's kind words. Around them, some of the medical crew had already begun to dematerialize in their return to the ship. As the people started to transport, the campsite that had provided the survivors shelter for the past month seemed more derelict than ever.
Did you manage to find anyone else?
Lars asked as they waited for transport. His eyes met Ezra's with desperate hope. Ezra did not want to tell him that he and his group were the only ones left alive until he received a reluctant nod of approval from Buck to give him his answer. Finally, he made a grim nod that was enough to tell Lars the ugly truth. Buck noticed that Ezra was trying to remain detached even though he was outraged just like the rest of them.
I regret to tell you that we have found no one. I am sorry.
Lars blinked hard and it seemed he might weep, but instead he swallowed visibly.
We had hoped someone might have survived. My wife, my 2 sons were at Colony 4.
His expression melted into a look of despair Ezra could barely tolerate. The man wanted to cry, but he would not do so yet. Ezra sensed that this was a man who held a lot within, but the last month had ravished that strong will to almost nothingness. And now, he had lost the only bindings of hope maintaining that strength forever. It was almost a relief when the transporter chief's voice broke the stillness of the air.
Commander, we are ready for you to transport.
Acknowledged. 3 to beam up.
Chapter 11. Thermopylae. Since arriving on the Maverick, Nathan Jackson had discovered the simple joy of being a doctor again by being able to mend broken bones and take care of real patients. Over the last few years, he felt himself somewhat distanced because of his research work and realized how much he missed it when it required him to spend most of his time in a laboratory. However, dealing with patients on a more personal basis had its own set of problems as well. Although the 20 people inside his sick bay would live after their ordeal on Omega 6, he still felt as if he should have been able to do more. At the moment, Josiah Sanchez had his hands full trying to offer comfort and counseling to the group in the face of their overwhelming loss. As he watched the older man practice his own brand of healing, Nathan could sense the frustration coming from him even though his face showed nothing but serenity. He could understand Josiah's feelings of helplessness because he knew he felt similarly impotent as well. The wounds of their flesh could heal easily enough, but the wounds of the mind were something else altogether.
They are not holding up well,
he commented once he managed to grab a quiet moment with the counselor.
I wish there were more we could do for them.
There are some things beyond us,
Josiah said softly.
All of them had families or friends at the colony. They haven't even begun the mourning process yet because they've been so focused on staying alive. The shock and disbelief I see in their faces is heart-wrenching.
I thought counselors are supposed to remain detached,
Nathan pointed out, knowing that it was anything but true of Josiah Sanchez. Nathan could see his empathy for these people despite his efforts to hide it, and knew Josiah often became more involved in his patients than he would like.
It's not a rule that I often adhere to.
Josiah confessed.
I don't believe in remaining detached. You can't offer someone insight into their mind if you can't even picture yourself in the same position. My wife was a doctor.
Josiah said with a fond smile when he remembered how Ayla used to deal with her patients and realized it was not so difficult to talk about her anymore.
She thought professional distance was more for our sake than it is for the patients.
She was a wise woman.
Nathan agreed. Suddenly, the doors to sick bay slid open and the captain, Buck and Ezra entered the room. Despite the mounting urgency of this whole affair of the intruder, Chris Larrabee seemed outwardly calm. Josiah knew from experience the casual smile he offered to the survivors was merely a facade. Buck stood by patiently as the captain made the rounds of the room, offering words of support to the patients and assurances that someone would be made accountable for the destruction of Colony 4. While nothing could assuage their grief, the former colonists seemed somewhat happier at knowing there would be justice for their lost loved ones. After Chris made the rounds, he and Buck finally approached the doctor.
How are they doing?
Chris asked, and from the tone of his voice, he was not inquiring after their physical state. Josiah spoke first.
They're exhausted. Some are still traumatized, but most are finally allowing themselves to grieve. They are angry, Captain, and justifiably so.
I can understand that.
Ezra replied.
If everything I loved and worked for has been obliterated the way Colonies 1 and 4 were, I know I would not be impressed.
Ezra, who was better than any of them at hiding his feelings, felt incensed to the core at what had happened on Calendar 2 and now on this world. As a security officer, he felt that he should have been able to do more to prevent the devastation, even though there was no way he could have done anything to stop it.
Doctor.
Buck spoke calmly, a sharp contrast to the thinly veiled annoyance in Ezra's voice.
We need to talk to Croft. He told us on the surface he had some information about what happened to them.
Nathan glanced at the man in question, who was lying on his bed staring at the ceiling. The doctor could see the sorrow in the man's face and knew that there was more than just loss at work there. It was a sense of failure as well. He looked to Nathan, a man who was usually prepared for everything, and this had taken him completely by surprise. There was a well of rage building inside him that was as potent as it was dangerous. If it did not find an outlet soon, Nathan dreaded to think of the consequences.
Medically, I think you would be up to a few questions,
Nathan admitted.
And mentally? Chris spoke for the first time. What is his mental state at the moment, Josiah?
He is angry, Captain, as they all are. However, it's worst for Croft. The pain is deeper somehow, more personal.
He was the mining supervisor?
Chris ventured to ask.
Yes.
Josiah answered.
How many died while they were waiting for rescue?
The captain asked again.
17.
Ezra replied, his jaw tightening as he answered.
It's a hard thing to lose people under your command. You feel as if there is something you should have been able to do to stop it, but sometimes, it's beyond your capability. Your mind knows better, but it's your heart that you have to convince.
At that, he made his way to Croft's bed with Buck following closely behind. Ezra let out a sigh, exchanging a knowing glance with both Nathan and Josiah before he too followed them towards the recovering supervisor. Although he was glad they found survivors on Omega 6, Chris was disappointed they had only been of 8 to 20 people about an entire colony. As he walked through sick bay earlier, speaking to the patients and trying to assist them in some understanding of what had taken place, his anger left a deep well of hatred in his stomach. It was a feeling that seemed to get much worse when he found himself facing Lars Croft. The sorrow in the man's face was evident, just as he was marked by his guilt. In that moment, Chris understood Lars' feelings better than anyone else in the room, bar none.
Supervisor Croft. Captain Chris Larrabee. Welcome aboard.
He was going to dispense with the pleasant inquiries about the man's health. At the moment, it seemed like a foolishly redundant question.
Captain, I want to thank you and your crew for your kindness since our arrival. We are grateful to you for our lives.
Don't mention it,
Chris said uncomfortably.
What help we were able to give you seems too little too late with how many were lost at the colony. We should be thanking you for that one consolation.
I guess neither of us are feeling terribly fortunate at this moment,
Lars remarked, easing back into his bed. Chris took a step forward and met his gaze.
I seem to be the better of the two.
There was a few seconds of silence before Chris decided to move on to the subject at hand.
Supervisor, you told Lieutenant Standish that there were some strange events occurring on Colony 4 prior to the destruction. Care to elaborate on that?
Yes, I can.
Lars nodded and straightened up. He seemed filled with purpose, knowing Chris would put the information to good use.
My team and I left the colony 2 days before the attack, but odd things were happening before that. It started a week earlier. Our computer expert Caroline O'Shea informed us someone had downloaded the entire contents of our main computer. Our computer is not very large for storage capacity, but it is a class 2 rating with security systems in place. Someone managed to swoop right in and download every terabyte of information stored.
Chris exchanged a glance with Buck, but neither said nothing and allowed Lars to continue.
We thought there might be Romulans about. We even sent out a few groups to make sure there was no one around. We used our tricorders to scan for life signs. There was nothing. Finally, we decided perhaps it was a computer glitch. Since no real harm was done, we let it go. However, 2 days before my team was meant to head out to the gorge, one of our geologists disappeared for 5 hours. We could not find him anywhere. We sent out search parties, ran sensor scans and tricorder readings. We actually thought he might have fallen somewhere and died.
But he was found,
Buck guessed.
As I said, 5 hours later we found him wandering about 2 miles from the colony. Not a scratch on him, but he seemed dazed at first and had no idea what happened. The man lost 5 hours of his memory.
Were you able to detect evidence of a transporter beam?
Ezra inquired.
Our equipment is not that sophisticated. We scanned the area with our sensor equipment for anything unusual, but there were no signs of it. All we could do was send a message to Deep Space 5, asking for a starship to come investigate.
Deep Space 5 never received that message,
Buck promptly informed him.
But we sent it. I am sure of it.
The intruders may have intercepted the message,
Ezra offered.
Secrecy is apparently a great consideration to them. Our investigation on Colony 1 indicates they are sophisticated enough to be able to jam a subspace signal easily.
Colony 1?
Lars asked, his eyes widening. Chris swore under his breath. He had not intended for Lars to learn about the destruction of Colony 1 yet, or the possible fate that might have inflicted on all the colonies in this sector. Unfortunately, the damage was done. He saw Ezra winced at unwittingly exposing that bit of information. Chris merely nodded at him, indicating that no real harm had been done. Nevertheless, he did not seem happy at his faux pas, but then gambling men rarely liked showing their hand prematurely.
I am sorry to tell you, Colony 1 has been destroyed in the same way as Colony 4. That is why we came here to check on you,
Chris said softly. Lars closed his eyes as if blocking out their faces would allow him to restrain his rage.
Who are these people? What do they want from us?
Please calm down. I know this is hard, but we need to know exactly what happened that day if we are to get to the bottom of this.
Although he still seemed highly agitated, Lars did manage to settle down a little and take into consideration the captain's request. After a moment, when he was better composed, he spoke again.
We were in the gorge when it happened. My team and I were working underground when there was a violent earth tremor. Measured at least 6 on the Richter. Most of us barely managed to get to the surface when the cavern came down. We lost Ryder and Pelkskuski in the cave-in.
He paused a moment in order to take a deep breath. Chris got the impression that his telling of the events was causing Lars to remember them with disturbing clarity.
When we surfaced, all we saw was this cloud of white smoke in the horizon. The temperature climbed up about 10 degrees above normal. Rodriguez, who was on the surface, told us there was an explosion. We certainly felt it down below.
Lars stopped speaking and he swallowed hard before continuing after collecting himself.
We tried raising the colony, but our communication channels were silent. At first, we weren't sure whether we ought to stay put in case they came after us. We hid underground for the first 2 days for cover until it was obvious they were not coming. We decided someone should go back to the settlement and see if anyone was left. Rodriguez, Johansson and Myers volunteered to go. I was not happy about it, but we needed to know. After a lot of debating, they took the hover car and went to the colony. They got back before nightfall.
His eyes drew dark and he did not need to go any further because they all shared his grief and knew what had happened next.
They couldn't even get 200 miles off the place. The tricorder and hover car sensors went critical the minute they reached the radius of the Berthold ray contamination. Even then, they came back sick with radiation poisoning. We knew then, no one had survived. If the explosion did not kill them, the radiation sickness would have.
He stopped speaking then and leaned back into his bed, with his eyes closed. Chris let his gaze move across the room and saw that both the patients and the medical crew had stopped to listen to Lars' account of things. Even Nathan, who was trying to stay focused on his other patients, seemed affected by the man's words. Chris did not even know what he could possibly say to lessen the impact of the tragedy.
I am so sorry,
Chris finally found himself saying, but the words felt meaningless when spoken.
We will find out who did this, I promise you.
Captain,
Josiah finally intervened.
I think that is enough for today. Mr. Croft needs his rest.
The expression in his eyes told them he would not accept any compromise on this. Nathan seemed to stand in the background, offering a show of solidarity even though he had not voiced it. Chris knew Josiah long enough to recognize that streak of steel inside the older man when a patient's mental state was at stake. He nodded slowly.
I think we have all that we need.
It was a lie, of course. They were no closer to the answer than they were after their arrival at Colony 1. However, Lars Croft and what was left of his team didn't need to know that. The meeting of the senior staff an hour later did not lift the oppressive black cloud hanging over the ship, with the exception of JD, who was needed on the bridge while they were all engaged in this discussion. Every bridge officer was present. Morale was dropping sharply. Chris could sense the tension that was beginning to affect everyone. He did not have to be a Betazoid telepath to know people were starting to become afraid. Something out here was killing helpless civilians indiscriminately and with callous regard. By now, the entire ship knew the intruder's vessel was emanating transwarp signatures and naturally escalated the belief the Borg were involved.
What have we learned?
Chris asked, opening the meeting.
The weapon used on Colony 4 is undoubtedly the same type used on Colony 1.
Alex volunteered first. She was a part of the away team that had transported to the destroyed settlement after survivors had been picked up. Hers was the most up-to-date information.
We were unable to remain on the surface for more than a few minutes, otherwise the transporter would have lost its lock on us. The whole area is in an advanced state of subatomic flux, definitely more pronounced than what we found on Colony 1, owing to the time differential.
The same destruction? Chris inquired.
Absolutely.
Ezra answered firmly.
The colony was utterly obliterated. Like Calendra 2, nothing was left standing. No buildings, no machinery, not even bodies. The only reason we know there were any at all is because of the DNA residue left behind.
Chris nodded, taking it all in.
Our science officer has theorized this complete destruction is for the purpose of concealment more than it was for an attack.
Concealment?
Josiah exclaimed.
What could be so important enough to justify such an extreme action?
Buck, let them in on what Captain Krista told us.
Sure. When we arrived at Deep Space 5, we were told the entire contents of the station's computer core had been downloaded. There were no ships close enough to do this when the theft took place, and yet it did. The intruder penetrated all Starfleet security protocols and took the data out of the main computer without raising a single alarm. According to Supervisor Croft, the same thing was done on Colony 4 prior to the attack, and we believe the same took place on Colony 1, although we'll never really know for certain. Our intruder seems to need information and a great deal of it. We're guessing what they took from Colony 1 and 4 did not meet their needs, and so they moved on to Deep Space 5.
So this is definitely not the Borg. The Borg have never displayed any need to learn anything of our species. After its initial contact with Picard's Enterprise, it had all the adequate information about us. Besides, they learn by assimilation.
Precisely. This is someone new. We know they have sophisticated weapons at their disposal, capable of destroying large areas without impunity. Their weapons are capable of affecting matter on a subatomic level, one of which we have no defense. We know our shields will not withstand penetration by this weapon if they were capable of slipping through the shields of a star base. Furthermore, they are either capable of matter displacement technology that far exceeds ours, or they possess a cloaking system unlike anything we have ever seen. Deep Space 5 navigational logs show no ships in the sector during the download, and yet we know there must have been a ship for it to have taken place.
What Commander Stiles is saying,
Chris broke in at that moment,
is that we're outgunned and underpowered to match the intruder.
So then what?
Vin Tanner spoke up. Chris noticed the officer of the con was starting to become more vocal in these meetings, even though it took some time for him to work up the nerve. Chris noticed Alex giving him a smile of encouragement to continue adding his voice to the discussion and was pleased. Someone else other than himself was taking a personal interest in the welfare of the young helmsman.
We can't run,
the Vulcan continued.
Doing that is just going to prove to them that we're weak and ripe for an invasion if they aren't thinking it already. We've got to show them that we got teeth, despite our weaknesses, and if they try to take the Federation, they'll have to fight for every inch of space between here and Sector 001.
I agree with Mr. Tanner.
Ezra spoke readily.
We must provide them with a reason to think that invading the Federation or the Alpha Quadrant will be less profitable with the amount of opposition they will be facing. Unfortunately, to do so we alone will have to face their ship and prevail.
We don't believe that an attack is what they have in mind.
Buck answered.
They seem to be after something in particular.
I agree. They have no reason to conceal themselves the way they do. If they are even half as formidable as we know them to be, we are no match for them. After obtaining so much Federation data, they ought to know it as well. My hunch says they want something specific and they're not going to tip their hand until they get it.
It does not look like we are in much position to stop them.
Chris did not say anything for a few seconds as he deliberated on that question.
We have to find them. Since we don't know what their intentions are in regards to this accumulation of data, we can't exclude the possibility these attacks aren't a prelude to invasion. Our course is clear. We have to find the intruders, and if it is not possible to negotiate some kind of peace agreement with them, we will have to use any means necessary to protect the security of the Federation.
I can offer a solution in that regard. Although, I warn you, it is extreme.
Go ahead, Lieutenant.
Chris replied, deciding that they had no choice at the moment and extreme might make all the difference when they face the intruder.
This is an alternative that can be used as a last resort if all our other efforts to stop the intruder fail. With some minor adjustments to the magnetic containment shield, we can create a relay on the bridge to precipitate a containment breach.
A self-destruct? Ezra exclaimed.
A self-destruct would merely destroy the ship with little damage to the surrounding area. Creating a containment breach with the amount of antimatter we possess would destroy any vessel in the resulting shock wave, despite their level of technology.
Is that really necessary?
Josiah asked. He did not like to think his first commission on board a starship would be his last.
If all else fails, it very well might be. Make your adjustments, Lieutenant. Create the relay. However, only me and Buck should be able to initialize it.
Of course.
Captain, under the circumstances, I recommend that we remain on yellow alert.
Good idea. In the meantime, I want Alex and you to find some way of protecting ourselves from this weapon of theirs. There should be a way to keep the shields from destabilizing when it comes into contact. Study the data accumulated from the two sites. See what you can come up with.
Yes, sir.
Neither Alex nor Ezra seemed very optimistic.
Nathan and Josiah, I want you to inform the civilians on board it would be wise to make preparations in case of evacuation.
Evacuation.
Nathan's eyes flew wide open.
Doctor, Chris said patiently. If the situation warrants it, we will separate the ship. The saucer section can return to Deep Space 5 without the loss of any more lives than necessary. A minimum complement is required to operate the starboard section of the ship, so we will be able to confront the intruder.
Nathan did not need to read the captain's mind to know that whoever remained on the starboard section would not return at all. The gesture was one of suicide, but under the circumstances, if such a thing could ever be called reasonable, it was a necessary sacrifice. Chris glanced at Mary and saw she did not at all like the idea of a suicide course, and the concern he saw was not just for her son, he was certain. There was something in her eyes as she looked at him that captured his gaze long enough for Chris to realize her worry for him was not because he was her captain but something more. Unfortunately, this was hardly the time for him to explore the depth of her growing emotions for him.
We will proceed immediately, Captain.
Josiah said softly. He did not want it to end like this, not so soon after their launch from Earth Starbase. The crew barely knew each other, let alone the ship. His heart ached knowing they might not ever get the chance to learn anything at all.
What shall we tell them?
You inform them this is a routine precaution when entering a critical situation.
Chris let his gaze move through the room and he could tell that his crew was afraid. Bridge officers did not show their apprehension easily, but their grim expression told him they shared the sentiment to a small degree.
I know things don't look good for us at the moment. However, this is mostly because we know very little about the intruder. Everything unknown poses a threat, so we must learn everything about them we can. Learning about our enemies will allow us to understand what motivates them. If we can discover what it is they need, we may come to a peaceful solution. However, I personally am not ready to believe this is a simple invasion. If they wanted to, the intruders have the technology to force a confrontation and win quite easily. I think all this concealment has another purpose, and we need to know what that is.
I agree.
Buck lent his voice to the captain's speech in a show of command solidarity.
Their actions show a fanatical need to remain anonymous, and whatever that reason may be, it could give us an edge.
We hope,
Nathan remarked.
Hope is all that Leonidas had at Thermopylae. Yet he managed to save a great many lives even though he had a very small force.
True,
the doctor nodded.
except Leonidas died in the process.
Chapter 12. Throwing out the book.
Commander Stiles. I do believe we are exhausting ourselves.
The science officer rubbed her eyes to shake the weariness out of them and decided she could not disagree with Ezra's opinion. They were pushing themselves hard. They had been working at an empty station in engineering for 5 hours now, and had made very little headway in fulfilling the captain's request in finding a defense against the intruder's weapons system. A difficult task in itself when one considered that they had not the least idea of how the thing worked. Well, that was not entirely true, Alex decided. She knew something of the physics that made what it did possible, but not the mechanics of such a device. The truth was, all their work could just be speculation until they actually saw the weapon in use. Alex had not planned on getting that close.
The captain wants a workable solution soon,
she replied and ran his calculations through the computer station once again.
I know. However, we will not find one if we work ourselves into exhaustion. This is no time for anyone to be anything less than fit for duty. We are not helping anyone by pushing ourselves like this, nor are we helping the ship. The captain needs to be able to rely on us, and he cannot do that if we are anything less than alert.
She looked around engineering and saw new faces had come on shift since she and Ezra started working on the problem of devising a reliable defense against the intruder. Chief Engineer Julia, however, was the exception. The woman was still working on creating a relay between the antimatter containment and the bridge. She shuddered inwardly at the thought they might actually be forced to use the desperate option. However, she did note something else during the past hours of being here.
You're right. Let's call it a day.
Good idea. Why don't we meet back here at 0800 hours in the morning?
I could use the sleep. Maybe it will give me more ideas on how to deal with the problem.
He nodded in agreement and his gaze shifted furtively towards entirely indifferent direction when he thought Alex was busy gathering her data pads and not paying attention.
It would help if you just go ask her out.
Alex smiled wryly. Ezra looked at her and felt an involuntary flush of red in his features. He had hoped no one had noticed him gazing in the direction of Julia Pemberton throughout the evening, least of all the science officer he was working with.
I have no idea what you are talking about,
Ezra said neutrally, betraying nothing because he was terribly embarrassed at being discovered. He could not help it though. Each time he saw that shimmer of red hair, he was utterly lost to the sparkle of it and wanted nothing more to run his fingers through it and see if it was really hair or strands of fine copper, not to mention those incredible emerald eyes. He wanted to stare forever in those pools of color.
Of course not. Well, it's your business.
She had no intention of involving herself further in this matter and wanted nothing more than to soak in the tub for an hour before going to bed.
I'll see you tomorrow,
Alex replied before making her exit. Ezra watched her go, unable to deny that she was right. He should go over there and say hello to Julia Pemberton. After all, considering what she had spent most of her labor during the last day upon, it would be prudent to seize the moment before they were forced to make the ultimate sacrifice. Clearing his throat and wondering when in the hell he ever felt this nervous, Ezra lingered a moment at the workstation, powering down the computer base in order for it to be utilized by someone else before he crossed the space between them. Ever since he had laid eyes upon her, he felt butterflies in his stomach and felt somewhat ridiculous about it. He was a grown man after all and the chief of security no less, and he had never had any trouble approaching the opposite sex about anything. He had faced Ferengi traitors, Romulan assassins and drunken Klingons. There was very little he had seen in his lifetime that could make him flinch, so there was no reason he should feel so anxious talking to a petite redhead.
How is our doomsday device progressing?
Ezra asked as he came up alongside of her.
Fine,
she answered, still working on the device, and responded without looking up.
It's about time you got up the nerve to talk to me. A girl could start to feel a little offended by how long it was taking you. I was actually starting to believe I'd have to go ask you myself, and that would not do. I'm an old-fashioned girl after all.
She met his gaze long enough to flash him a radiant smile. Ezra winced inwardly and felt supremely stupid.
Was I that obvious?
He asked, clearing his throat, feeling his embarrassment burn to the tips of his ears, but it did not feel too terrible in light of her own revelations.
Not at all.
Her fingers working deftly over the innards of the relay sitting on top of her workbench.
You wore quite the poker face, but then I am told that is your expertise, isn't it?
I have been known to indulge in games of chance,
he replied casually,
wondering how deeply she had made her inquiries about him and was rather annoyed that as chief security officer, someone could do so without his being any the wiser.
I hear you are a bona fide card sharp and that if there's a game on this ship, you know about it. You're a bundle of contradictions, Mr. Standish. Fortunately, I like paradoxes.
Really?
Ezra found himself smiling, now that he had recovered from the surprise of finding out that this stiff-haired beauty shared possibly the same feelings for him that he had for her, if she had been determined enough to go find out all about him.
I have been told that I am something of a riddle.
Now that's more like it, Commander. I like it when you take the initiative.
Are you always this sure about yourself, Lieutenant Pemberton?
Ezra asked, folding his arms and staring at her. He had thought simply staring at her was enough to send tingles through his skin. He had no idea she was this enchanting to talk to as well. Ezra thrived on challenges, and a woman who could knock him off his poised feet was quite formidable indeed.
Not always.
Her eyes moving up and down his form as if she had made some secret decision about him she was not about to let him in on just yet.
Then there are times, and I know without doubt that this is the best thing for me.
Ezra could actually understand that. How many pivotal moments in his life had come upon him knowing just the right thing to do? He could not even count, whether or not it was in a card game or accepting this posting under Chris Larrabee's command. Ezra had known with an instinct that made him the gambler he was today, that there could be no other choice but the one he had made. His heart leapt inside his chest knowing that she had come to that same decision about him. However, he was not about to become too presumptuous by that fact, because Lieutenant Pemberton herself was something of a riddle and she liked to play games. That was fine with him, games were his specialty. Chris stared into stars beyond the window of his ready room when the door chimed softly. "Come in," he sang out after letting out a weary sigh. The door slid open and Josiah walked into the room, cradling a bottle of blue liquid. He knew the doctor had a collection of exotic spirits that had come on board with him from Earth. Usually, the emergence of a bottle indicated Josiah felt particularly verbal and had selected him as company. According to the chronometer on his desk, Chris saw it was approaching 1900 hours. That meant he had been sitting in this chair, staring into space for almost a good hour.
"To what do I owe this visit?"
Chris asked, sitting up in his chair. He could not deny that Josiah's presence was a welcome one. The counselor was the one person around whom he could unburden himself to completely, within reason of course.
"I thought you could use some of this."
He gestured to the bottle in his hand.
"What is it?"
Chris inquired, leaning forward to examine the contents closely after Josiah had put the bottle down on his desk.
"Romulan ale."
"Ah, mother's milk."
Chris grinned and rose from his chair. He went to the replicator panel and made a short request from the computer. After a brief shimmer of energy, Chris returned to the desk with two clear crystal glasses. When Josiah had filled both receptacles, Chris took a deep sip from his glass and savored the taste in his mouth. It was particularly pleasing. The ale was authentic. Somehow, he was not looking forward to a synthahol-flavored substitute. For a few minutes, neither man spoke, but Chris was sure Josiah was reading his thoughts and his mood more clearly than spoken words could ever express.
"You think the strain is getting to me?"
Chris stated, putting down his glass. Josiah smiled, knowing the question was rhetorical. Not that he would have answered it anyway. He knew Chris had a great deal of difficulty articulating how he felt, and such conversations needed to be preceded with delicate caution.
"Your attitude at the briefing earlier hardly inspired confidence,"
Josiah answered after a while. He could not deny that Chris's words during that meeting had bothered him a great deal.
"Comparing us to Leonidas of Sparta is somewhat fatalistic, don't you think?"
"I was trying to be realistic,"
Chris responded coolly.
"I don't think our chances of surviving this encounter is any secret. Even a fool would have to recognize the odds are against us."
"You don't know that. In fact, no one does for certain. We haven't even sighted the enemy. All we have is a great deal of speculation and not a lot of practical knowledge. Your strategy should not be focused on the outcome of us not surviving the encounter. Even Starfleet's finest needs to have hope they can come out of this alive."
"I don't need to see it with my own eyes to know what happened on Colony 1 and 4 was anything but formidable. Wishful thinking is not going to change that."
Chris was unable to deny he was starting to feel defensive.
"I agree with that assessment as well as you do,"
Josiah answered, not willing to let this matter slide just yet.
"The intruders, whomever they are capable of destroying all of us. However, we should not make it any easier for them to do it. Assuming the best that we can hope for during an encounter is to take them with us, is not the way to proceed. You did not think that way when you faced the Borg. The man I put back together in Starfleet Medical would never have sat still for that.
What do you want from me? I am doing the best I can. Do you think this is any easier for me? I've waited all my life for this.
He looked around the room.
All my life, I've worked hard and done everything expected of me, and all my life everything I want has been taken away through no fault of mine. My son and my wife just to start with. I get over that as best I can and finally get my own ship. Do you think I could have been given the chance to enjoy her, at least for a while? No, on our first mission out, I have to be saddled with this. An intruder that will most likely cut through our shields and turn us into solar dust before we even have time to respond. It's not fair.
Life isn't fair, and you of all people should know that by now.
Josiah responded just as vehemently. It was no secret he thought of Chris Larrabee as more than a friend. Chris was the son he always wanted. He loved his own children dearly, but Mara and Santa had always been so practical and level-headed. They had taken after their mother and seldom needed Josiah's guidance or understood their father enough to tolerate the seed of wanderlust inside his veins. From the first moment he had met Chris Larrabee, Josiah felt a kinship that was deeper than friendship. It was a bond as thick as blood, because Chris understood that wild streak of madness that gripped all great pioneers over the precipice of destiny. Chris had given him a chance to realize a dream. At a point in his life where he thought all dreams were ended. So Josiah Sanchez was not going to allow protocol or anything else to keep him from helping the brave man who had saved him from himself.
You are the captain of this ship. You are the standard by which everyone on board measures himself. Yes, you are still new to them, but they believe in you because you are the man who saved the Rutherford. Most of the ships destroyed by the Borg did not allow for survivors, but yours did. You saved half your crew when most others were lucky to escape with a handful. Don't you think everyone on board knows that?
Chris said nothing, and his silence further infuriated the counselor.
How dare you think anything becomes simpler when you are a captain? You worked all your life for this, and you of all people should know the price that comes with captain's gold. You've paid it more than any man has to pay for anything. We need you to be strong for us, or no one on board this ship is going to survive the confrontation. That, Captain Larrabee, is something I don't need to be telepathic to know.
Although the words seemed to bounce of him, Chris knew otherwise. The substance of them had penetrated right to his core and touched upon that secret part of himself he wished no one could see. Josiah was right, of course. Chris almost expressed a faint smile at the realization, but managed to hold it. Counselor Josiah Sanchez reminded him of his father so much that there were times when it was hard for him to distinguish this passionate doctor from the father who dithered about in his library of musty books. To this day, whenever he smelled stale paper, Chris remembered his father. Now, he no longer even needed that. He just had Josiah.
You are a pain in the ass, counselor.
Chris conceded finally before taking another sip of his ale.
But what you said has been duly noted.
Well, I'm glad something did.
I don't want to lose another crew, Josiah.
The young captain said honestly.
This is more than I expected from my first command. I wanted to get to know everyone before it came to this. I never got to know the people on the Rutherford. I was too busy being first officer and preparing myself for my first command to understand how important people are. It's important to know people while there's still time.
He looked away and crushed mercilessly the private pain that made a sudden resurgence at that remark.
I wanted Buck to be my first officer because I promised myself that when I came on board, I wasn't going to let the crew simply become uniforms to me. Buck has a way of doing that.
I can imagine. Look, I don't need to tell you that things don't always turn out the way they're meant to. Starfleet made you a captain because you've got that spark most fleet officers would sell their souls to have. Do what Chris Larrabee wants to do, from the gut, no hesitation or no regrets. I have more faith in that impulse than anything in the rulebook.
Thanks.
Chris chuckled softly.
But I may tear the ship apart by throwing out that book.
It felt better being able to admit to someone he was not as confident as everyone expected him to be. Once again, he thanked whatever reasoning led him to making Josiah the offer of the post of counselor. He had a feeling that if they were to survive the next few days, Buck and Josiah between them both were going to have to become the gyroscope that centered his emotional balance and give him a swift kick when he needed it.
Incidentally,
Josiah spoke, moving to a completely different subject altogether, even though he was uncertain if this topic would be as well received as the earlier had been. If anything, it was likely to be just as provocative.
I don't mean to pry, but I thought I'd mention this since I am counselor and I'm responsible for bringing this up, no matter how awkward it may be.
Of course not,
Chris said wearily. There was little point trying to guess what Josiah was getting at. Sooner or later,
The man would make his point.
Go ahead anyway.
You have some very strong feelings about Lieutenant Travis.
Chris' eyes met Josiah's sharply. That was the one thing he wanted no one on board to know. Buck had been giving him enough hell on the subject, trying to play matchmaker by goading him into spending more time with the woman. Now, he had to contend with Josiah too. Although he knew both Buck and Josiah meant well, there were some things that he considered too intimate to share with anyone, and his feelings for Mary definitely fell into that category.
That, my friend, is none of your business.
Ah, I see.
Even though he was not smirking or smiling, or showing any outward expression on his face, Chris knew Josiah well enough to know his mind was actively analyzing Chris's response. The remark was meant to bait him, and to Chris's chagrin, the ploy was working quite effectively. Unable to resist, Chris found himself asking,
"What do you see?"
"Nothing,"
the man said innocently.
"Why don't I believe you?"
Josiah hesitated as he tried to put the feelings he was sensing between the two people into words that could accurately describe the situation. After a moment of consideration, he finally responded,
"It just felt like I sensed an emotional attachment between you and her."
At that, he looked up quickly to see Chris's reaction. The captain did not seem the least bit concerned.
"Believe me, whatever you sense was probably not mutual."
Josiah downed the last of his drink and then rose to his feet. The captain remained seated and looked deep in thought. Despite the woman's aloof manner, Josiah had been a counselor long enough to know that was not the case, not in the slightest. He waited for a second before he added quietly,
"I wouldn't say that."
The captain looked up at him instantly with eyes widened once the implications of that remark sank into his brain.
"What do you mean?"
Chris asked, a great deal more animated than Josiah had seen him in some time.
"Did she say something?"
he asked, unable to contain the excitement in his voice that his feelings for Mary might be reciprocated. Josiah tried not to laugh, but it was difficult to control his facial expressions at that point.
"It's getting late. You can keep the bottle of ale. I've got more down in my office."
Josiah estimated he had precious few moments left before he started laughing.
"Wait a minute. You can't just leave. What did you hear from? This is not funny, counselor. I want to know."
"Should I pass her notes too?"
Josiah grinned as he started for the door.
"I could make it an order, you know."
Chris tried again, ignoring the remark. Although he knew he was playing into Josiah's hands, this curiosity would not be abated.
"Come on, Josiah, this is not funny. What does she think of me?"
"Good night, Captain."
The counselor grinned and made a speedy exit before his captain started the practice of keel hauling again. Vintaner was at the bar indulging in something called a Boston mud cake when he heard a voice behind him. Looking over his shoulder, it took a few seconds before he actually faced the person to recognize the voice. His memory for these things was quite good, and he was usually able to identify them immediately. However, as he finally faced the speaker, Vin found himself surprised by whom it was.
"Lieutenant Richmond,"
he said, unable to hide his shock, especially after how she had treated him at their first meeting.
"Hello, Vin."
Vin wanted to know since when were they on a first-name basis.
"Can I do something for you, Lieutenant?"
he asked cautiously, uncertain of what she wanted of him. From the corner of his eye, he saw the door to Four Corners sliding open and felt eager to end this discussion with the lieutenant when he saw Alex Stiles walking into the room. Alex paused a moment and surveyed Four Corners before she caught sight of him and Charlotte. Vin panicked, thinking she might leave seeing he was not alone, but instead her expression changed. If he did not know better, he would say it hardened as she came towards them.
"My friends and I wondered."
Charlotte glanced at a few women seated at the table at the far corner of the room who were watching the proceedings with great amusement.
"Is it true that Vulcans reach sexual maturity much later than humans?"
Vince stared at her with no idea what to say. He could understand her curiosity, of course. Vulcan sexuality was one of the most closely guarded aspects of the culture. There was very little on it for the knowledge of the general public, remembering the hell he had gone trying to find something on the subject himself. However, the smirk on her face did not appear as if she were making the inquiry in the pursuit of knowledge, but rather to embarrass him.
"That's true,"
he stammered, aware she was waiting for an answer and decided the truth was the best he could do at this moment.
"So you're not sexually mature yet?"
she pointed out, because according to his record, he was young by Vulcan standards.
"You're still a virgin."
Vin turned deep red and was about to stand up and make a hasty departure when Alex reached them both. The science officer had heard the exchange and was giving the crewmen witnessing this entire event a scathing glare that sent them scurrying.
Charlotte Richmond had not noticed her yet since she was too busy humiliating the Vulcan in public.
A virgin? I would hardly think so.
Charlotte turned to see the commander and visibly gulped when she realized that Vin's relationship with the third-ranking officer on the Maverick was anything but professional. Vin could share Charlotte's astonishment when he felt Alex's hand slide over his shoulders, caressing the length of his muscle. Her palm inched languidly over the curve of his biceps, pausing long enough for her to feel the taut flesh beneath his uniform. While he was uncertain of what she was doing, he could not say it did not feel unpleasant to have him touch him. So few people wanted to touch Vulcans, and even fewer wanted to touch him because he was something different. However, nothing could prepare Vin for the surprise he got when she pressed her mouth against his and slipped her tongue through his teeth. He had never been kissed this way before and knew human males found this very arousing, but he found it more pleasant to have her skin against his and to be able to breathe in the scent of her hair. He liked how her palm felt against his cheek and the way her body moved closer to his, and was disappointed when she pulled away. Alex gave him a little wink, which he did not understand, and kept her arm where it was over his shoulder before saying sweetly,
"Vin, darling, do you think I could have a moment with the lieutenant alone?"
Why was she calling him darling, and what had happened to her voice?
Vin thought to himself.
"Okay,"
he said, puzzled, picking up his plate of Boston mud and retiring to one of the free tables. As soon as he was gone, Alex turned her eye on Charlotte, who was starting to look very nervous. Alex could not blame her. She had good reason to be afraid. It was never wise to anger the third in command of a starship.
"Commander,"
Charlotte started to stammer.
"Lieutenant Richmond, believe you are in stellar cartography, am I correct?"
"Yes, sir."
Charlotte nodded, seeking moral support from her friends who had all but disappeared in the light of her troubles.
"Unless you want to be spending the next 6 months on monitor duty during the graveyard shift, I suggest you limit your interaction with Lieutenant Tanner to a professional basis. If I find out you are harassing him again about his Vulcan heritage, I'll have you brought up on charges of xenophobia. Do you understand me?"
"Yes, sir,"
she replied promptly and clearly shaken, because xenophobia was grounds for immediate discharge from Starfleet. Alex took a step closer to her and whispered in his softer voice,
"You disobey me on this and I'll eat you alive. Do we understand each other, Lieutenant?"
"Perfectly."
Charlotte swallowed and started to leave when Alex spoke sharply,
"I did not say you were dismissed, Richmond."
Charlotte's face flushed red with anger but held her tongue, because anything she said would immediately be construed as insubordination.
"Now you're dismissed,"
she remarked with a little smile of satisfaction, and was pleased to see Charlotte slinking away fearfully before Alex went to find Vin.
"I'm sorry about that,"
Alex said, sliding into the seat next to him in the booth where he was waiting for her.
"She pissed me off.
She was trying to embarrass me,"
Vin replied, even though he was more curious as to why Alex had done what she had instead of Charlotte's cruelties.
"Why did you kiss me?"
Alex cleared her throat and tried to think of an answer, since there was no real reason except perhaps the fact she did not want anyone sniggering behind Vin's back.
"I didn't want her to make fun of you and to put to rest any further comments she might have regarding your sexuality. Did you mind?"
"No, it's just, no one has kissed me before."
"When you're in a position to appreciate it, I'm sure there will be a line."
She smiled warmly and then stood up.
"Well, I've put in a long day, so I'm going to get some rest. You take care, okay?"
Alex said as she left him. Vin watched her go and decided when he was in a position to appreciate it, he would not want anyone else but her.